Thank you for coming, Dr. Robin J. Wilson.
Hi there.
Watching the story of J.C. Dugard, many of us wondered if this could happen to kids we know. Tell us how common sex offenders like Philip Garrido are.
Sexual offending is a crime that is, of course, very close to our hearts. We're very much upset whenever we hear about this sort of thing. So these sorts of stories tend to stick with us. But in all reality, these sorts of crimes are really quite rare. In fact, they're so rare that we make a really big deal about them. All of the news media coverage that happened when we first found out about her is a perfect example of just exactly how unfamiliar we are with this sort of thing. If it was the sort of thing that happened every week or every month, we'd be a little more desensitized.
Now, Diane Sawyer said there's 100 children who are not returned to their families fairly quickly after they're abducted. And of those, 50 don't return at all. That seems like a really small group of people.
Of course, those are very small numbers. When we consider the population of the United States and the numbers of sexual offenses that occur every year, numbers like 50 not being returned is an incredibly small number. That's approximately one per state. So these are incredibly rare events. As a parent, I can tell you that I also live with fears about my children. But the fears that I have about my children are they going to get into a car drunk? Are they going to drive? Are they going to take some substance? Or is somebody going to put something in their drink? Is somebody going to treat them badly? These are the sorts of things I'm really concerned about because I know what the realities are with respect to sexual abuse. Most children are sexually abused within their own home. I'm fortunate enough to say that none of my children were ever abused in my home.
That's something that feminists said, that most abuse happens in families, and that's still true, is that not?
Yes, it is, absolutely. And it's a matter of both kind of familiarity and also just sheer access.
Why don't we hear more in the media stories from families?
What happens within family dynamics is not of the sort of really horrific sorts of cases, the ones that lead to the lurid details like this Philip Garrido, J.C. Dugard story. And this is so horrific that some young girl could be abducted when she's preteen and held for 18 years. This is absolutely the most horrific sort of thing we can think about. That doesn't happen within family settings very often.
And it doesn't lead to as many interesting details.
No, certainly not.
Philip Garrido was a already convicted sex offender. He'd been in jail. Is it common that sex offenders reoffend?
Not all sex offenders are the same. They have the difficulties to varying degrees. There are some offenders who are really incorrigible, they really like to offend, they have no interest in stopping, and those are the sorts of fellows who are extremely high risk, and those are the kind of guys we need to keep really close eye on. The average sex offender, as I said before, is a guy from a family setting, probably not with an extensive history of offending, probably not with an extensive history of other social behavioral problems, and that sort of fellow is at much less risk to reoffend.
You've been working in civil commitment centers, which are the places where people have finished their sentence and whoever's in charge says this person is too violent and too risky to be out in the general population. So I take it you've been around some of these really high-risk folks.
Yeah, I've been working with sex offenders for probably the last 27 years or more. I've seen many thousands of offenders over my career. And the offenders we find within most civil commitment centers tend to be among the highest risk fellows. Those guys are rare. When we look at the process of actually civilly committing some of these offenders, we're talking about less than 2% of all the sexual offenders we identify. In the state of Florida, for instance, only 1.5% of all the sex offenders who have been evaluated since there has been a Sexually Violent Predator Act in this state, only 1.5% of all the sex offenders coming through the system have eventually been sent to the Florida Civil Commitment Center as a sexually violent predator. That's an incredibly small percentage.
And are these people that, well, let me back up a minute, because you are a part of pioneering something called the Circles of Support and Accountability, which is a model of wraparound care and intentional community for persons who sexually offend and are at particularly high risk to reoffend. So that's
right.
Been trumpeted by the restorative justice movement. It's been in use for 16 years. We have a track record on it. Is it something that people in civil commitment centers can benefit from?
I see absolutely no reason why it wouldn't be applicable to people who were in some of the civil commitment centers. I think it's safe to say that there are some people within civil commitment centers who are probably going to spend the rest of their life there, and that's probably a good thing. I don't believe that that's the case for most of the fellows who are found in those sorts of settings. With the right treatment, with the right support, with the right care, and with the right kind of network of people who are going to help keep them accountable if they get released back to the community, I think these fellows can return to society and be able to reassume a functional role.
So tell us about it. How is this possible with these circles?
Some of these fellows, when they get to the stage in their life where they have engaged in years and years of abuse, they're really socially ostracized. And that's understandable, I expect, given the sorts of crimes that they've been involved in. But when it comes right down to it, if we are going to believe that any of these folks is actually redeemable, that they can come back to the community, we have to start thinking about how we're going to replace what's been lost. And by their offending, they've largely alienated themselves from anyone who might have ever cared about them. They've probably offended against family members. They've probably offended against friends. They've really burned all of their social bridges. A circle of support is actually quite innovative. The idea is that you take a group of volunteers from the community, ordinary citizens, give them a little bit of training and understanding about sex offender dynamics, and then ask them to spend time with these fellows, helping them to make good decisions, helping them to stay honest, helping them to stay on the straight and narrow so that they don't start falling back into old ways. One of the neat things about the model is that this inner circle of the offender plus his volunteers is circled by a group of experts, psychologists, parole officers, law enforcement, those sorts of people who have expert knowledge about working with offenders who can assist that inner circle in making good decisions should they come up against something that either they don't know how to manage or they shouldn't know how to manage. We don't expect our volunteers to act as de facto psychologists. We want them to be members of the community who care about safety and who are willing to do something about that other than be armchair critics when things go wrong.
A couple things come to my mind. One is, these are not people who've shown themselves to be very interested in community or friendship feedback. And then, aren't they wild and dangerous people, cunning people that ordinary citizens would have a hard time seeing through?
Those are certainly the kind of prevailing beliefs for most of the public, that sex offenders are eternally vile people who can be no different. In my experience, and I've had quite a number of years doing this work, I've certainly seen some failures, but I've seen an awful lot more successes. And I think the successes are born of a process that understands what the risk factors are, specifically targets what those problem areas might be that these guys might fall into once they get released back to the community. And, you know, given the extent of their offense history, it's not too hard to figure out what those problems are, and then actually dealing with them. People who have support and friendly advice and guidance tend to do better in life. I succeed in life because I have a family who cares about me. I have friends who care about me.
This concept of a circle of support and accountability, it's very idealistic. Is anybody actually using it?
The circles model is now used in 6 or 8 different countries around the world. There are over 1,000 offenders who have been helped through this model, and I'm very pleased to say that we have almost exclusively set out to work with guys that I would say are the worst of the worst of the ones who get out. So we're not talking about the guys serving life sentences. We're talking about guys who have an actual finite sentence, but the ones who are at the highest risk range. The effect of the circles model in terms of the reoffense rates has been absolutely dramatic, up to 70% or greater reductions in the rates of any new kind of sexual offense.
Do you find that the sex offender himself wants to deal with these problems? You get into treatment, you have to want to change.
Right. That's the first step always. If you're uninterested in making any changes, surprise, surprise, you won't make any. There are certainly offenders who are more along the psychopathic line who are not particularly interested in being anything other than what they are right now. That's not the majority of offenders. The majority of offenders, deep down, they understand that they've engaged in behavior that is unconscionable, that makes them a target for hatred and anger and a whole pile of other very strong emotions, all of which is perfectly understandable given how we feel about sexual offending. However, I think we need to keep in mind that the vast majority of these guys were raised in the same basic Judeo-Christian Ten Commandments upbringing that the most of us were. They know right from wrong. For some reason, they've been able to turn that off at times in their lives, and our job is to find a way to help them keep those rules on so that they can't override them and go back to offending behavior. if they continue to offend, they're going to spend the rest of their life in jail. Jail is not a fun place. I've worked in a number of them. They're not fun places. When we look at the data that comes from the scientific studies, the vast majority of these fellows are going to go back to the community and they're not going to reoffend.
So most sex offenders get out of jail, they come back, they have no friends or family left, and there's parole. Talk to me about that.
In your state, you have a law that says that every registered sex offender has to have one of those GPS bracelets, regardless of the level of risk he poses. Your very worst guy who got released to the street is being supervised not so differently from the very best guy that you released to the street. If you were to use some of the risk assessment tools that we have at our disposal to make a better decision about which guys truly need that versus the ones that don't, we could probably save law enforcement an awful lot of time in monitoring the low-risk offenders who probably don't need that level of actual supervision. That would free them up to perhaps spend more time with the higher-risk guys.
Tom Amiano has a bill this session of the legislature that might deal with a little bit of that, but it's obviously incredibly expensive to monitor someone on a GPS. JC's mom said that she's filled with hate. She says something has to change. She's determined to do something about it. And I'm thinking that most people who watched her say those things thought, yeah, that's right, we got to do something. More punishment, more police. What would you say to them?
Those are absolutely natural responses. I can't imagine what it would be like to be JC's mother. I can't imagine what it would be like to try to debrief with my child such an absolutely horrific experience. I don't know if I could trust myself not to beat the offender with a baseball bat if I were in the same room with him. Those are very realistic responses to the experiences that these poor folks have gone through. Those are not the people, however, that we should be allowing to determine public policy. Nothing born of emotion is probably ever done all that well. At some point, people who are a little bit removed from it, perhaps a little bit more objective, need to be the ones to make the hard decisions about whether or not this really warrants rewriting the book. We have a natural tendency to try to fix problems. Whenever something terrible occurs, we think we need to fix something. The truth is, in any good system, something always goes wrong. We cannot get rid of every single opportunity for error. We cannot get rid of every opportunity that someone may make a mistake or some random event that might occur. But we need to build our policies around the sorts of things that happen often enough that we can actually do something about it. I completely understand why the family is angry. I completely understand why they're absolutely horrified. I understand the hatred directed towards this fellow Garrido. But this is not the sort of case on which we should be making sweeping changes to public policy, because in the end, I'm not sure that making sweeping changes will actually stop these random events from occurring.
So tell us where people could find out more about Circles of Support and Accountability. Is there any program in the Bay Area that they might be able to get involved in?
There is not a Circles project in the Bay Area, although there is a very well-established one at University in Fresno. If you want to read more about the Circles model, do a simple Google search.
Is there anything else you'd like to add?
The greatest solution to many of these sorts of issues is to have greater involvement in the process by average citizens. When we allow only the lawmakers, only the bureaucrats, only the policymakers to make these sorts of choices for us, we lose some of that down-home, grassroots, community-based feeling of what it's actually like. We need to remember that most sexual offenses happen within family circumstances. When we make punishments harsher and harsher and harsher, we probably tend to decrease the rate of actual reporting of these crimes because families don't want to see their family member essentially thrown away. Any of your listeners who are interested in being involved in a Circles project, we would welcome their involvement.
I've been talking to Dr. Robin J. Wilson, who is one of the leading experts in sex offender treatment. Thanks a lot for coming in today.
Okay, great. Thanks for having me.